This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and Other Clinical Tales. Written by Oliver Sacks. Narrated by Jonathan Davis. With an introduction written and read by Oliver Sacks.
I am Oliver Sacks. In 1985, I published a book of case histories, stories of patients I had seen in my work as a neurologist, mostly in old age homes. To my intense surprise, and my publisher's too, these stories, with their rich metaphoric and human archetypes, resonated with readers, and the book took on a life of its own. The last thing one settles in writing a book, Pascal observes, is what one should put in first. So, having written, collected, and arranged these strange tales, having selected a title and two epigraphs, I must now examine what I have done, and why. I feel myself a naturalist and physician, both, and I am equally interested in diseases and people. Perhaps, too, I am equally, if inadequately, a theorist and dramatist, am equally drawn to the scientific and the romantic, and continually see both in the human condition, not least in that quintessential human condition of sickness. Animals get diseases, but only man falls into sickness. My work, my life, is all with the sick, but the sick and their sickness drives me to thoughts which perhaps I might otherwise not have. So much so that I am compelled to ask, with Nietzsche, as for sickness, are we not almost tempted to ask whether we could get along without it? And to see the questions it raises as fundamental in nature. Constantly my patients drive me to question, and constantly my questions drive me to patients. Thus, in the stories or studies which follow, there is a continual movement from one to the other. Studies, yes, but why stories or cases? Hippocrates introduced the historical conception of disease, the idea that diseases have a course from their first intimations to their climax or crisis, and thence to their happy or fatal resolution. Hippocrates thus introduced the case history, a description or depiction of the natural history of disease, precisely expressed by the old word pathography. Such histories are a form of natural history, but they tell us nothing about the individual and his history. They convey nothing of the person and the experience of the person as he faces and struggles to survive his disease. There is no subject in a narrow case history. Modern case histories allude to the subject in a cursory phrase, a trisomic albino female of 23, which could as well apply to a rat as a human being. To restore the human subject at the center, the suffering, afflicted, fighting human subject, we must deepen a case history to a narrative or tale. Only then do we have a who as well as a what, a real person, a patient, in relation to disease, in relation to the physical. The patient's essential being is very relevant in the higher reaches of neurology and in psychology, for here the patient's personhood is essentially involved, and the study of disease and of identity cannot be disjoined. Such disorders, and their depiction and study, indeed entail a new discipline, which we may call the neurology of identity, for it deals with the neural foundations of the self, the age-old problem of mind and brain. It is possible that there must of necessity be a gulf of category, between the psychical and the physical, but studies and stories pertaining simultaneously and inseparably to both, and it is these which especially fascinate me, and which on the whole I present here, may nonetheless serve to bring them nearer, to bring us to the very intersection of mechanism and life, to the relation of physiological processes to biography. The tradition of richly human clinical tales reached a high point in the 19th century, and then declined with the advent of an impersonal neurological science. The great Russian neuropsychologist A.R. Luria wrote, "The power to describe, which was so common to the great 19th century neurologists and psychiatrists, is almost gone now. It must be revived." Luria's own late works, such as The Mind of a Mnemonist and The Man with a Shattered World, are attempts to revive this lost tradition. Thus, the case histories in this book hark back to an ancient tradition, to the 19th century tradition of which Luria speaks, to the tradition of the first medical historian, Hippocrates, and to that universal and prehistorical tradition by which patients have always told their stories to doctors. Classical fables have archetypal figures, heroes, victims, martyrs, warriors. Neurological patients are all of these, and in the strange tales told here, they are also something more. How, in these mythical or metaphorical terms, shall we categorize the lost mariner, or the other strange figures in this book? We may say that they are travelers to unimaginable lands, lands of which otherwise we should have no idea or conception. This is why their lives and journeys seem to me to have a quality of the fabulous, why I have used Osler's Arabian Nights image as an epigraph, and why I feel compelled to speak of tales and fables as well as cases. The scientific and the romantic in such realms cry out to come together. Luria liked to speak here of romantic science. I hope you will enjoy The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat.
To talk of diseases is a sort of Arabian Nights entertainment. William Osler. The physician is concerned, unlike the naturalist, with a single organism, the human subject, striving to preserve its identity in adverse circumstances. Ivy McKenzie. Part 1. Losses. Introduction. Neurology's favorite word is deficit, denoting an impairment or incapacity of neurological function. Loss of speech, loss of language, loss of memory, loss of vision, loss of dexterity, loss of identity, and myriad other lacks and losses of specific functions or faculties. For all of these dysfunctions, another favorite term, we have privative words of every sort. Aphonia, aphemia, aphasia, alexia, apraxia, agnosia, amnesia, ataxia, a word for every specific neural or mental function of which patients, through disease or injury or failure to develop, may find themselves partly or wholly deprived. The scientific study of the relationship between brain and mind began in 1861, when Broca, in France, found that specific difficulties in the expressive use of speech, aphasia, consistently followed damage to a particular portion of the left hemisphere of the brain. This opened the way to a cerebral neurology, which made it possible, over the decades, to map the human brain, ascribing specific powers, linguistic, intellectual, perceptual, etc., to equally specific centers in the brain. Toward the end of the century, it became evident to more acute observers, above all to Freud, in his book Aphasia, that this sort of mapping was too simple, that all mental performances had an intricate internal structure and must have an equally complex physiological basis. Freud felt this especially in regard to certain disorders of recognition and perception, for which he coined the term agnosia. All adequate understanding of aphasia or agnosia would, he believed, require a new, more sophisticated science. The new science of brain-mind, which Freud envisaged, came into being in the Second World War, in Russia, as the joint creation of A.R. Luria and his father, R.A. Luria, Leontiev, Anochin, Bernstein, and others, and was called by them neuropsychology. The development of this immensely fruitful science was the life work of A.R. Luria, and considering its revolutionary importance, it was somewhat slow in reaching the West. It was set out systematically in a monumental book, Higher Cortical Functions in Man, and in a wholly different way in a biography or pathography, The Man with a Shattered World. Although these books were almost perfect in their way, there was a whole realm which Luria had not touched. The Higher Cortical Functions in Man treated only those functions which appertained to the left hemisphere of the brain. Similarly, Zazetsky, subject of The Man with a Shattered World, had a huge lesion in the left hemisphere. The right was intact. Indeed, the entire history of neurology and neuropsychology can be seen as a history of the investigation of the left hemisphere. One important reason for the neglect of the right, or minor hemisphere, as it has always been called, is that while it is easy to demonstrate the effects of variously located lesions on the left side, the corresponding syndromes of the right hemisphere are much less distinct. It was presumed, usually contemptuously, to be more primitive than the left, the latter being seen as the unique flower of human evolution. And in a sense, this is correct. The left hemisphere is more sophisticated and specialized, a very late outgrowth of the primate, and especially the hominid brain. On the other hand, it is the right hemisphere which controls the crucial powers of recognizing reality which every living creature must have in order to survive. The left hemisphere, like a computer tacked onto the basic creatural brain, is designed for programs and schematics. And classical neurology was more concerned with schematics than with reality. So that when, at last, some of the right hemisphere syndromes emerged, they were considered bizarre. There had been attempts in the past, for example, by Anton in the 1890s and Petzl in 1928, to explore right hemisphere syndromes. But these attempts themselves had been bizarrely ignored. In The Working Brain, one of his last books, Luria devoted a short but tantalizing section to right hemisphere syndromes, ending, "These still completely unstudied defects lead us to one of the most fundamental problems, to the role of the right hemisphere in direct consciousness. The study of this highly important field has been so far neglected. It will receive a detailed analysis in a special series of papers, in preparation for publication." Luria did finally write some of these papers in the last months of his life, when mortally ill. He never saw their publication, nor were they published in Russia. He sent them to R.L. Gregory in England, and they appear in Gregory's Oxford Companion to the Mind. Inner difficulties and outer difficulties match each other here. It is not only difficult, it is impossible for patients with certain right hemisphere syndromes to know their own problems. A peculiar and specific onosognosia, as Babinski called it. And it is singularly difficult for even the most sensitive observer to picture the inner state, the situation of such patients, for this is almost unimaginably remote from anything he himself has ever known. Left hemisphere syndromes, by contrast, are relatively easily imagined. Although right hemisphere syndromes are as common as left hemisphere syndromes, why should they not be? We will find 1,000 descriptions of left hemisphere syndromes in the neurological and neuropsychological literature for every description of a right hemisphere syndrome. It is as if such syndromes were somehow alien to the whole temper of neurology. And yet, as Luria says, they are of the most fundamental importance, so much so that they may demand a new sort of neurology, a personalistic, or, as Luria liked to call it, a romantic science. For the physical foundations of the persona, the self, are here revealed for our study. Luria thought a science of this kind would be best introduced by a story. A detailed case history of a man with a profound right hemisphere disturbance. A case history which would at once be the complement and opposite of the man with a shattered world. In one of his last letters to me, he wrote, "Publish such histories, even if they are just sketches. It is a realm of great wonder." I must confess to being especially intrigued by these disorders, for they open realms or promise realms scarcely imagined before, pointing to an open and more spacious neurology and psychology, excitingly different from the rather rigid and mechanical neurology of the past. It is then less deficits in the traditional sense which have engaged my interest than neurological disorders affecting the self. Such disorders may be of many kinds and may arise from excesses, no less than impairments of function. And it seems reasonable to consider these two categories separately. But it must be said from the outset that a disease is never a mere loss or excess, that there is always a reaction on the part of the affected organism or individual to restore, to replace, to compensate for, and to preserve its identity, however strange the means may be. And to study or influence these means, no less than the primary insult to the nervous system, is an essential part of our role as physicians. This was powerfully stated by Ivy McKenzie. For what is it that constitutes a disease entity or a new disease? The physician is concerned not, like the naturalist, with a wide range of different organisms theoretically adapted in an average way to an average environment, but with a single organism, the human subject, striving to preserve its identity in adverse circumstances. This dynamic, this striving to preserve identity, however strange the means or effects of such striving, was recognized in psychiatry long ago, and, like so much else, is especially associated with the work of Freud. Thus, the delusions of paranoia were seen by him not as primary, but as attempts, however misguided, at restitution, at reconstructing a world reduced by complete chaos. In precisely the same way, Ivy McKenzie wrote, "The pathological physiology of the Parkinsonian syndrome is the study of an organized chaos, a chaos induced in the first instance by destruction of important integrations and reorganized on an unstable basis in the process of rehabilitation." As Awakenings was the study of an organized chaos produced by a single, if multiform, disease, so what now follows is a series of similar studies of the organized chaoses produced by a great variety of diseases. In this first section, losses, the most important case, to my mind, is that of a special form of visual agnosia. The man who mistook his wife for a hat. I believe it to be of fundamental importance. Such cases constitute a radical challenge to one of the most entrenched axioms or assumptions of classical neurology, in particular, the notion that brain damage, any brain damage, reduces or removes the abstract and categorical attitude, in Kurt Goldstein's term, reducing the individual to the emotional and concrete. A very similar thesis was made by Hewlings Jackson in the 1860s. Here, in the case of Dr. P, we see the very opposite of this. A man who has, albeit only in the sphere of the visual, wholly lost the emotional, the concrete, the personal, the real, and been reduced, as it were, to the abstract and the categorical, with consequences of a particularly preposterous kind. What would Hewlings, Jackson, and Goldstein have said of this? I have often, in imagination, asked them to examine Dr. P, and then said, "Gentlemen, what do you say now?" Chapter 1 The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Dr. P was a musician of distinction, well known for many years as a singer, and then at the local school of music as a teacher. It was here, in relation to his students, that certain strange problems were first observed. Sometimes a student would present himself, and Dr. P would not recognize him, or specifically would not recognize his face. The moment the student spoke, he would be recognized by his voice. Such incidents multiplied, causing embarrassment, perplexity, fear, and sometimes comedy. For not only did Dr. P increasingly fail to see faces, but he saw faces when there were no faces to see. Genially, Magoo-like, when in the street he might pat the heads of water hydrants and parking meters, taking these to be the heads of children. He would amiably address carved knobs on the furniture and be astounded when they did not reply. At first, these odd mistakes were laughed off as jokes, not least by Dr. P himself. Had he not always had a quirky sense of humor and been given to zen-like paradoxes and jests? His musical powers were as dazzling as ever. He did not feel ill. He had never felt better. And the mistakes were so ludicrous and so ingenious that they could hardly be serious or betoken anything serious. The notion of there being something the matter did not emerge until some 3 years later, when diabetes developed. Well aware that diabetes could affect his eyes, Dr. P consulted an ophthalmologist, who took a careful history and examined his eyes closely. "There's nothing the matter with your eyes," the doctor concluded, "but there is trouble with the visual parts of your brain. You don't need my help. You must see a neurologist." And so, as a result of this referral, Dr. P came to me. It was obvious within a few seconds of meeting him that there was no trace of dementia in the ordinary sense. He was a man of great cultivation and charm who talked well and fluently, with imagination and humor. I couldn't think why he had been referred to our clinic. And yet, there was something a bit odd. He faced me as he spoke, was oriented towards me, and yet there was something the matter. It was difficult to formulate. He faced me with his ears, I came to think, but not with his eyes. These, instead of looking, gazing at me, taking me in the normal way, made sudden, strange fixations. On my nose, on my right ear, down to my chin, up to my right eye, as if noting, even studying these individual features, but not seeing my whole face, its changing expressions, me as a whole. I'm not sure that I fully realized this at the time. There was just a teasing strangeness, some failure in the normal interplay of gaze and expression. He saw me. He scanned me. And yet, "What seems to be the matter?" I asked him at length.
"Nothing that I know of," he replied with a smile. "But people seem to think there's something wrong with my eyes."
"But you don't recognize any visual problems?"
"No, not directly, but I occasionally make mistakes."
I left the room briefly to talk to his wife. When I came back, Dr. P was sitting placidly by the window, attentive, listening rather than looking out.
"Traffic," he said. "Street sounds, distant trains. They make a sort of symphony, do they not? You know Onager's Pacific 231? "What a lovely man," I thought to myself. "How can there be anything seriously the matter? Would he permit me to examine him?"
"Yes, of course, Dr. Sachs."
I stilled my disquiet, his perhaps too, in the soothing routine of a neurological exam, muscle strength, coordination, reflexes, tone. It was while examining his reflexes, a trifle abnormal on the left side, that the first bizarre experience occurred. I had taken off his left shoe and scratched the sole of his foot with a key, a frivolous-seeming but essential test of a reflex. And then, excusing myself to screw my ophthalmoscope together, left him to put on the shoe himself. To my surprise, a minute later, he had not done this. "Can I help?" I asked.
"Help what?"
"Help whom?"
"Help you put on your shoe."
"Ah," he said, "I had forgotten the shoe."
Adding sotto voce,
"The shoe. The shoe."
He seemed baffled.
"Your shoe?"
I repeated.
"Perhaps you'd put it on?"
He continued to look downwards, though not at the shoe, with an intense but misplaced concentration. Finally, his gaze settled on his foot.
"That is my shoe, yes?"
Did I mishear? Did he missee?
"My eyes," he explained, and put a hand to his foot. "This is my shoe, no?"
"No, it is not. That is your foot. There is your shoe."
"Ah,
I thought that was my foot." Was he joking? Was he mad? Was he blind? If this was one of his strange mistakes, it was the strangest mistake I had ever come across. I helped him on with his shoe, his foot, to avoid further complication. Dr. P himself seemed untroubled, indifferent, maybe amused. I resumed my examination. His visual acuity was good. He had no difficulty seeing a pin on the floor, though sometimes he missed it if it was placed to his left. He saw all right, but what did he see? I opened out a copy of the National Geographic magazine and asked him to describe some pictures in it. His responses here were very curious. His eyes would dart from one thing to another, picking up tiny features, individual features, as they had done with my face. A striking brightness, a color, a shape would arrest his attention and elicit comment, but in no case did he get the scene as a whole. He failed to see the whole, seeing only details, which he spotted like blips on a radar screen. He never entered into relation with the picture as a whole, never faced, so to speak, its physiognomy. He had no sense whatever of a landscape or scene. I showed him the cover, an unbroken expanse of Sahara dunes. "What do you see here?" I asked.
"I see a river," he said. "And little guest house with its terrace on the water. People are dining out on the terrace. I see colored parasols here and there."
He was looking, if it was looking, right off the cover into midair and confabulating non-existent features, as if the absence of features in the actual picture had driven him to imagine the river and the terrace and the colored parasols. I must have looked aghast, but he seemed to think he had done rather well. There was a hint of a smile on his face. He also appeared to have decided that the examination was over and started to look around for his hat. He reached out his hand and took hold of his wife's head, tried to lift it off, to put it on. He had apparently mistaken his wife for a hat. His wife looked as if she was used to such things. I could make no sense of what had occurred in terms of conventional neurology or neuropsychology. In some ways, he seemed perfectly preserved, and in others, absolutely, incomprehensibly devastated. How could he, on the one hand, mistake his wife for a hat, and, on the other, function, as apparently he still did, as a teacher at the music school. I had to think, to see him again, and to see him in his own familiar habitat, at home. A few days later, I called on Dr. P. and his wife at home. With the score of the Dichterliebe in my briefcase, I knew he liked Schumann, and a variety of odd objects for the testing of perception. Mrs. P. showed me into a lofty apartment which recalled Fin du siècle Berlin. A magnificent old Bösendorfer stood in state in the center of the room, and all around it were music stands, instruments, scores. There were books, there were paintings, but the music was central. Dr. P. came in, a little bowed and distracted, advanced with outstretched hand to the grandfather clock, but, hearing my voice, corrected himself and shook hands with me. We exchanged greetings and chatted a little of current concerts and performances. Diffidently, I asked him if he would sing.
"Verdichterliebe," he exclaimed. "But I can no longer read music.
You will play them, yes?" I said I would try. On that wonderful old piano, even my playing sounded right. And Dr. P. was an aged but infinitely mellow Fischer Disco, combining a perfect ear and voice with the most incisive musical intelligence. It was clear that the music school was not keeping him on out of charity. Dr. P.'s temporal lobes were obviously intact. He had a wonderful musical cortex. What, I wondered, was going on in his parietal and occipital lobes, especially in those areas where visual processing occurred? I carried the platonic solids in my neurological kit and decided to start with these. "What is this?" I asked, drawing out the first one. "A cube, of course." "Now this?" I asked, brandishing another. He asked if he might examine it, which he did swiftly and systematically. "A dodecahedron, of course, and don't bother with the others. I'll get the icosahedron, too." Abstract shapes clearly presented no problems. What about faces? I took out a pack of cards. All of these he identified instantly, including the jacks, queens, kings, and the joker. But these, after all, are stylized designs, and it was impossible to tell whether he saw faces or merely patterns. I decided I would show him a volume of cartoons, which I had in my briefcase. Here again, for the most part, he did well. Churchill's cigar, Schnozzle's nose. As soon as he had picked out a key feature, he could identify the face. But cartoons, again, are formal and schematic. It remained to be seen how he would do with real faces, realistically represented. I turned on the television, keeping the sound off, and found an early Betty Davis film. A love scene was in progress. Dr. P. failed to identify the actress, but this could have been because she had never entered his world. What was more striking was that he failed to identify the expressions on her face or her partner's, though in the course of a single torrid scene, these passed from sultry yearning through passion, surprise, disgust, and fury to a melting reconciliation. Dr. P. could make nothing of any of this. He was very unclear as to what was going on, or who was who, or even what sex they were. His comments on the scene were positively Martian. It was just possible that some of his difficulties were associated with the unreality of a celluloid Hollywood world, and it occurred to me that he might be more successful in identifying faces from his own life. On the walls of the apartment, there were photographs of his family, his colleagues, his pupils, himself. I gathered a pile of these together and, with some misgivings, presented them to him. What had been funny or farcical in relation to the movie was tragic in relation to real life. By and large, he recognized nobody. Neither his family, nor his colleagues, nor his pupils, nor himself. He recognized a portrait of Einstein because he picked up the characteristic hair and mustache, and the same thing happened with one or two other people. "Ach, Paul," he said, when shown a portrait of his brother. "That square jaw, those big teeth, I would know Paul anywhere." But was it Paul he recognized, or one or two of his features, on the basis of which he could make a reasonable guess as to the subject's identity? In the absence of obvious markers, he was utterly lost. But it was not merely the cognition, the gnosis, at fault. There was something radically wrong with the whole way he proceeded. For he approached these faces, even of those near and dear, as if they were abstract puzzles or tests. He did not relate to them. He did not behold. No face was familiar to him, seen as a thou, being just identified as a set of features, an it. Thus, there was formal, but no trace of personal gnosis. And with this went his indifference or blindness to expression. A face, to us, is a person looking out. We see, as it were, the person through his persona, his face. But for Dr. P, there was no persona in this sense, no outward persona, and no person within. I had stopped at a florist on my way to his apartment and bought myself an extravagant red rose for my buttonhole. Now I removed this and handed it to him. He took it like a botanist or morphologist given a specimen, not like a person given a flower. "About 6 inches in length," he commented. "A convoluted red form with a linear green attachment." "Yes," I said encouragingly. "And what do you think it is, Dr. P?" "Not easy to say." He seemed perplexed. "It lacks the simple symmetry of the Platonic solids, although it may have a higher symmetry of its own. I think this could be an inflorescence or flower." "Could be," I queried. "Could be," he confirmed. "Smell it," I suggested, and he again looked somewhat puzzled, as if I had asked him to smell a higher symmetry. But he complied courteously and took it to his nose. Now, suddenly, he came to life. "Beautiful," he exclaimed. "An early rose. What a heavenly smell." He started to hum Die Rosa, die Lili. Reality, it seemed, might be conveyed by smell, not by sight. I tried one final test. It was still a cold day in early spring, and I had thrown my coat and gloves on the sofa. "What is this?" I asked, holding up a glove. "May I examine it?" he asked, and taking it from me, he proceeded to examine it as he had examined the geometrical shapes. "A continuous surface," he announced at last, "enfolded on itself. It appears to have," he hesitated, "five outpouchings, if this is the word." "Yes," I said cautiously. "You have given me a description. Now tell me what it is." "A container of some sort?" "Yes," I said. "And what would it contain?"
"It would contain its contents," said Dr. P. with a laugh. "There are many possibilities. It could be a change purse, for example, for coins of five sizes. It could..." I interrupted the balmy flow. "Does it not look familiar?"
Do you think it might contain, might fit a part of your body? No light of recognition dawned on his face. Later, by accident, he got it on and exclaimed, "My God, it's a glove!" This was reminiscent of Kurt Goldstein's patient, Lanuti, who could only recognize objects by trying to use them in action. No child would have the power to see and speak of the continuous surface enfolded on itself, but any child, any infant, would immediately know a glove as a glove, see it as familiar as going with a hand. Dr. P. didn't. He saw nothing as familiar. Visually, he was lost in a world of lifeless abstractions. Indeed, he did not have a real visual world, as he did not have a real visual self. He could speak about things, but did not see them face to face. Hewlings-Jackson, discussing patients with aphasia and left hemisphere lesions, says they have lost abstract and propositional thought, and compares them with dogs, or rather he compares dogs to patients with aphasia. Dr. P., on the other hand, functioned precisely as a machine functions. It wasn't merely that he displayed the same indifference to the visual world as a computer, but, even more strikingly, he construed the world as a computer construes it, by means of key features and schematic relationships. The scheme might be identified, in an identikit way, without the reality being grasped at all. The testing I had done so far told me nothing about Dr. P.'s inner world. Was it possible that his visual memory and imagination were still intact? I asked him to imagine entering one of our local squares from the north side, to walk through it in imagination or in memory, and tell me the buildings he might pass as he walked. He listed the buildings on his right side, but none of those on his left. I then asked him to imagine entering the square from the south. Again, he mentioned only those buildings that were on the right side, although these were the very buildings he had omitted before. Those he had seen internally before were not mentioned now. Presumably, they were no longer seen. It was evident that his difficulties with leftness, his visual field deficits, were as much internal as external, bisecting his visual memory and imagination. What at a higher level of his internal visualization? Thinking of the almost hallucinatory intensity with which Tolstoy visualizes and animates his characters, I questioned Dr. P. about Anna Karenina. He could remember incidents without difficulty, had an undiminished grasp of the plot, but completely omitted visual characteristics, visual narrative, and scenes. He remembered the words of the characters, but not their faces. And though, when asked, he could quote, with his remarkable and almost verbatim memory, the original visual descriptions, these were, it became apparent, quite empty for him, and lacked sensorial, imaginal, or emotional reality. Thus there was an internal agnosia as well. But this was only the case, it became clear, with certain sorts of visualization. The visualization of faces and scenes, of visual narrative and drama, this was profoundly impaired, almost absent. But the visualization of schemata was preserved, perhaps enhanced. Thus, when I engaged him in a game of mental chess, he had no difficulty visualizing the chessboard or the moves, indeed no difficulty in beating me soundly. I have often wondered about Helen Keller's visual descriptions, whether these, for all their eloquence, are somehow empty as well, or whether, by the transference of images from the tactile to the visual, or yet more extraordinarily, from the verbal and the metaphorical to the sensorial and the visual, she did achieve a power of visual imagery, even though her visual cortex had never been stimulated directly by the eyes. But in Dr. P's case, it is precisely the cortex that was damaged, the organic prerequisite of all pictorial imagery. Interestingly and typically, he no longer dreamed pictorially. The message of the dream being conveyed in non-visual terms. Luria said of Zazetsky that he had entirely lost his capacity to play games, but that his vivid imagination was unimpaired. Zazetsky and Dr. P lived in worlds which were mirror images of each other. But the saddest difference between them was that Zazetsky, as Luria said, fought to regain his lost faculties with the indomitable tenacity of the damned. Whereas Dr. P was not fighting, did not know what was lost, did not indeed know that anything was lost. But who was more tragic and who was more damned, the man who knew it or the man who did not? When the examination was over, Mrs. P called us to the table, where there was coffee and a delicious spread of little cakes. Hungrily, hummingly, Dr. P started on the cakes. Swiftly, fluently, unthinkingly, melodiously, he pulled the plates towards him and took this and that in a great gurgling stream, an edible song of food, until, suddenly, there came an interruption. A loud, peremptory rat-tat-tat at the door. Startled, taken aback, arrested by the interruption, Dr. P stopped eating and sat frozen, motionless at the table, with an indifferent, blind bewilderment on his face. He saw, but no longer saw the table, no longer perceived it as a table laden with cakes. His wife poured him some coffee. The smell titillated his nose and brought him back to reality. The melody of eating resumed. How does he do anything? I wondered to myself. What happens when he's dressing? Goes to the lavatory? Has a bath? I followed his wife into the kitchen and asked her how, for instance, he managed to dress himself. It's just like the eating, she explained. I put his usual clothes out in all the usual places, and he dresses without difficulty, singing to himself. He does everything singing to himself. But if he is interrupted and loses the thread, he comes to a complete stop, doesn't know his clothes or his own body. He sings all the time, eating songs, dressing songs, bathing songs, everything. He can't do anything unless he makes it a song. While we were talking, my attention was caught by the pictures on the walls. Yes, Mrs. P said. He was a gifted painter as well as a singer. The school exhibited his pictures every year. I strolled past them curiously. They were in chronological order. All his earlier work was naturalistic and realistic, with vivid mood and atmosphere, but finely detailed and concrete. Then, years later, they became less vivid, less concrete, less realistic and naturalistic, but far more abstract, even geometrical and cubist. Finally, in the last paintings, the canvases became nonsense. Or nonsense to me, mere chaotic lines and blotches of paint. I commented on this to Mrs. P. Ah, you doctors, you're such Philistines, she exclaimed. Can you not see artistic development? How he renounced the realism of his earlier years and advanced into abstract, non-representational art. No, that's not it, I said to myself, but forbore to say it to poor Mrs. P. He had indeed moved from realism to non-representation to the abstract, yet this was not the artist, but the pathology advancing. advancing towards a profound visual agnosia, in which all powers of representation and imagery, all sense of the concrete, all sense of reality were being destroyed. This wall of paintings was a tragic pathological exhibit, which belonged to neurology, not art. And yet, I wondered, was she not partly right? For there is often a struggle, and sometimes, even more interestingly, a collusion between the powers of pathology and creation. Perhaps in his Cubist period there might have been both artistic and pathological development colluding to engender an original form, for as he lost the concrete, so he might have gained in the abstract, developing a greater sensitivity to all the structural elements of line, boundary, contour, an almost Picasso-like power to see and equally depict those abstract organizations embedded in and normally lost in the concrete. Though in the final pictures, I feared there was only chaos and agnosia. We returned to the great music room with the Bösendorfer in the center and Dr. P. humming the last torte.
"Well, Dr. Sachs," he said to me, "you find me an interesting case, I perceive. Can you tell me what you find wrong? Make recommendations."
"I can't tell you what I find wrong," I replied, "but I'll say what I find right. You are a wonderful musician, and music is your life. What I would prescribe in a case such as yours is a life which consists entirely of music. Music has been the center. Now make it the whole of your life." This was 4 years ago. I never saw him again, but I often wondered about how he apprehended the world, given his strange loss of image, visuality, and the perfect preservation of a great musicality. I think that music, for him, had taken the place of image. He had no body image. He had body music. This is why he could move and act as fluently as he did, but came to a total confused stop if the inner music stopped. And equally with the outside, the world. Thus, as I learned later from his wife, though he could not recognize his students if they sat still, if they were merely images, he might suddenly recognize them if they moved.
"That's Carl," he would cry. "I know his movements, his body music."
In The World as Representation and Will, Schopenhauer speaks of music as pure will. How fascinated he would have been by Dr. P., a man who had wholly lost the world as representation, but wholly preserved it as music, or will. And this mercifully held to the end. For despite the gradual advance of his disease, a massive tumor or degenerative process in the visual parts of his brain, Dr. P. lived and taught music to the last days of his life. Postscript. How should one interpret Dr. P.'s peculiar inability to interpret, to judge, a glove as a glove? Manifestly here, he could not make a cognitive judgment, though he was prolific in the production of cognitive hypotheses. A judgment is intuitive, personal, comprehensive, and concrete. We see how things stand in relation to one another and oneself. It was precisely this setting, this relating, that Dr. P. lacked, though his judging in all other spheres was prompt and normal. Was this due to lack of visual information or faulty processing of visual information? This would be the explanation given by a classical schematic neurology. Or was there something amiss in Dr. P.'s attitude so that he could not relate what he saw to himself? These explanations or modes of explanation are not mutually exclusive. Being in different modes, they could coexist and both be true. And this is acknowledged implicitly or explicitly in classical neurology. Implicitly by McCrae when he finds the explanation of defective schemata or defective visual processing and integration inadequate. Explicitly by Goldstein when he speaks of abstract attitude. But abstract attitude, which allows categorization, also misses the mark with Dr. P. And perhaps with the concept of judgment in general. For Dr. P. had abstract attitude, indeed, nothing else. And it was precisely this, his absurd abstractness of attitude, absurd because unleavened with anything else, which rendered him incapable of perceiving identity, or particulars rendered him incapable of judgment. Neurology and psychology, curiously, though they talk of everything else, almost never talk of judgment. And yet, it is precisely the downfall of judgment, whether in specific realms, as with Dr. P., or more generally, as in patients with Korsakoff's or frontal lobe syndromes, which constitutes the essence of so many neuropsychological disorders. Judgment and identity may be casualties, but neuropsychology never speaks of them. And yet, whether in a philosophic sense, Kant's sense, or an empirical and evolutionary sense, judgment is the most important faculty we have. An animal, or a man, may get on very well without abstract attitude, but will speedily perish if deprived of judgment. Judgment must be the first faculty of higher life or mind. Yet it is ignored or misinterpreted by classical computational neurology. And if we wonder how such an absurdity can arise, we find it in the assumptions or the evolution of neurology itself. For classical neurology, like classical physics, has always been mechanical. From Hewling's, Jackson's mechanical analogies to the computer analogies of today. Of course, the brain is a machine and a computer. Everything in classical neurology is correct. But our mental processes, which constitute our being and life, are not just abstract and mechanical, but personal as well. And as such involve not just classifying and categorizing, but continual judging and feeling also. If this is missing, we become computer-like, as Dr. P. was. And by the same token, if we delete feeling and judging, the personal, from the cognitive sciences, we reduce them to something as defective as Dr. P. And we reduce our apprehension of the concrete and real. By a sort of comic and awful analogy, our current cognitive neurology and psychology resemble nothing so much as poor Dr. P. We need the concrete and real as he did, and we fail to see this as he failed to see it. Our cognitive sciences are themselves suffering from anagnosia essentially similar to Dr. P.'s. Dr. P. may therefore serve as a warning and parable of what happens to a science which eschews the judgmental, the particular, the personal, and becomes entirely abstract and computational. It was always a matter of great regret to me that, owing to circumstances beyond my control, I was not able to follow his case further, either in the sort of observations and investigations described, or in ascertaining the actual disease pathology. One always fears that a case is unique, especially if it has such extraordinary features as those of Dr. P. It was therefore with a sense of great interest and delight, not unmixed with relief, that I found, quite by chance, looking through the periodical Brain for 1956, a detailed description of an almost comically similar case. similar, indeed identical, neuropsychologically and phenomenologically, though the underlying pathology, an acute head injury, and all personal circumstances were wholly different. The authors speak of their case as unique in the documented history of this disorder, and evidently experienced, as I did, amazement at their own findings. The interested reader is referred to the 1956 original paper by McCrae and Trolla, of which I here subjoin a brief paraphrase with quotations from the original. Their patient was a young man of 32 who, following a severe automobile accident with unconsciousness for 3 weeks, complained exclusively of an inability to recognize faces, even those of his wife and children. Not a single face was familiar to him, but there were three he could identify. These were workmates, one with an eye-blinking tick, one with a large mole on his cheek, and a third because he was so tall and thin that no one else was like him. Each of these, McCrae and Trolla bring out, was recognized solely by the single prominent feature mentioned. In general, like Dr. P, he recognized familiars only by their voices. He had difficulty even recognizing himself in a mirror, as McCrae and Trolla describe in detail. In the early convalescent phase, he frequently, especially when shaving, questioned whether the face gazing at him was really his own. And even though he knew it could physically be none other, on several occasions grimaced or stuck out his tongue just to make sure. By carefully studying his face in the mirror, he slowly began to recognize it, but not in a flash as in the past. He relied on the hair and facial outline and on two small moles on his left cheek. In general, he could not recognize objects at a glance, but would have to seek out and guess from one or two features. Occasionally, his guesses were absurdly wrong. In particular, the authors note there was difficulty with the animate. On the other hand, simple schematic objects, scissors, watch, key, etc., presented no difficulties. McCrae and Trolla also note that his topographical memory was strange. The seeming paradox existed that he could find his way from home to hospital and around the hospital, but yet could not name streets en route. Unlike Dr. P, he also had some aphasia, or appeared to visualize the topography. It was also evident that visual memories of people, even from long before the accident, were severely impaired. There was memory of conduct, or perhaps a mannerism, but not of visual appearance or face. Similarly, it appeared, when he was questioned closely, that he no longer had visual images in his dreams. Thus, as with Dr. P, it was not just visual perception, but visual imagination and memory, the fundamental powers of visual representation, which were essentially damaged in this patient. At least those powers insofar as they pertained to the personal, the familiar, the concrete. A final humorous point. Where Dr. P might mistake his wife for a hat, McCrae's patient, also unable to recognize his wife,